evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm your host, John Tanza, on this live broadcast from Washington. Here are some of the top stories making news across South Sudan and the East Africa region on this Thursday, July 11, 2024. Kenyan President William Ruto fires his whole cabinet.
I have today, in line with the powers given to me by Article 1521 and 1525B of the Constitution and Sections 12 of the Office of the Attorney General's Act, decided to dismiss with immediate effect all the Cabinet Secretaries and Attorney General of the Cabinet of Kenya.
And the UN Human Rights Council says South Sudan's National Security Act violates human rights across the country.
The clandestine way in which the NSS has operated will mean that, in fact, people will get picked up in the country and nobody will actually know about what has happened to them.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. President Salva Kiir fired his Minister of Finance, who was just 4 months into the job. Reuters news agency says it is the sixth replacement in the post since 2020. Mr. Kiir gave no reasons for firing Awoh Daniel Chuang, who was appointed in mid-March. Mariel Deng has been tapped to replace him as finance minister. South Sudan's economy has been under pressure in recent years with crude oil export revenue dwindling because of the conflict in neighboring Sudan. Still on cabinet issues, the Kenyan president, William Ruto, has dismissed all ministers except the Minister for Foreign Affairs. The dismissal comes after weeks of protest calling the president to fire allegedly corrupt and non-performing ministers. Mohammed Yusuf has more for VOA from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi.
Kenyan President William Ruto succumbed to pressure from protesters and dissolved his cabinet. Speaking at the State House on Thursday, Ruto said that due to the country's recent political and economic situation, he has decided to fire his ministers.
Upon reflection, listening keenly to what the people of Kenya have said, and after a holistic appraisal of the performance of my cabinet and its achievements and challenges, I have today, in line with the powers given to me by Article 1521 and 1525B of the Constitution and Sections 12 of the Office of the Attorney General's Act, decided to dismiss with immediate effect all the Cabinet Secretaries and Attorney General of the Republic of Kenya, of the Cabinet of Kenya.
Ruto said he will consult across different sectors and establish a broad-based government that will assist him in running the country's affairs. At the president's urging, Parliament last month passed a finance bill that included several tax increases, but Ruto declined to sign the bill after protesters stormed Parliament. Clashes between police and protesters in Nairobi and elsewhere left at least 41 people dead. Kenyan political activist Boniface Mwangi, one of the protest organizers, told VOA Ruto needs to change the way he operates.
We are very happy because it's the beginning of the end for him as well. We cannot have an incompetent government in power. We cannot have a government that kills its young people in power. So unless he reforms, changes his ways, people have moved from saying the finance bill is bad because it was rejected, to him we must go. He has been holding the parliament as hostage because nothing that happens in this country there is approval. So you need to understand that you cannot run a country by yourself. So if he doesn't listen to its young people, they're going to send him home.
The government says the absence of additional tax revenue will negatively impact government programs and foreign loan payments. However, many Kenyans argue the government collects sufficient revenue but losses it through corruption that goes unpunished. Political commentator Martin Andati says time is not on Ruto's side, adding that the president cannot expect to make parliament and other institutions do his bidding without pushback from the people.
He thought he will buy time. You tell Kenyans you will do a task force and all this kind of nonsense. But Kenyans have seen through it all. So, you know, politically, he is living in 1994. The Kenyan youth are in 2034, miles and miles ahead of him. So you try all these shenanigans, they're able to see through it. But, you know, the cure to all these things is just strictly following the constitution. There are a lot of checks and balances on institutions. So he must give the institutions powers and let the institutions work.
Kenyan protesters who call themselves tribeless and leaderless have planned a new series of demonstrations next week to protest the long-standing problem of police killings, disappearances and abductions. Mohammed Yusuf, VOA News, Nairobi.
From Nairobi, we move back to Juba, where some internally displaced persons living in UN-protected civilian sites say they want South Sudan to sign a peace agreement with holdout groups at the Tumaini negotiations in Nairobi. The IDPs say conditions in the camps are terrible and they need lasting peace so they can go back to their homes. For VOA News, Viola Elias reports from Juba.
Thousands of internally displaced persons living in the camps around Juba town say they are anxious to go home. Sunday Touch, who was displaced by conflict in 2013, says since the United Nations mission in South Sudan and other organizations withdraw support, families sheltering at UN-protected sites are going through tough times. She says the non-signatories of the 2018 Revitalize Agreement meeting in Nairobi should negotiate in good faith to bring lasting peace in South Sudan.
Even if we are starving, may God soften their hearts so they will sign a peace agreement, because we want to see everyone happy. We want to remain in our houses regardless of whether we are hungry. As long as we can stay at home without any issues, I'll be content. Even in the absence of peace, I would really like to return home because of the circumstances, both inside and outside the camp, are the same throughout Juba.
John Kong wrote, another IDP sheltering at POC 3 in Juba, says he does not expect any positive outcome from the Nairobi talks.
Not even in the recent peace talks in Nairobi have we witnessed anything. We will only discuss things that have a favorable result. Nothing else will be discussed. Here, we are starving and nobody wants to help us. Not even the government. We are dying here today. We buried 25 individuals who passed away from starvation.
Paul Pitia, one of the chiefs at POC 3, urges the groups at the peace negotiation in Nairobi to forgive each other.
Just as you disagreed with someone in the past, when you decided to sit at the negotiating table and agreed on reconciliation, it must be so.
Ruot warns the government against bribing the IDPs during election.
The government or officials should not think about us only when elections are approaching. A person who dies cannot vote, and each vote can lead to a person's success in the elections.
Chapter 5 of the Revitalized Peace Agreement commits the transitional government to form three transitional justice institutions: Truth, Reconciliation and Healing, for post-war investigation, the Hybrid Court for Justice for Victims, and the Compensation and Reparation Authority for citizens whose property was destroyed in the conflict. The chairperson of the Relief and Rehabilitation Commission, Peter Gatwich Kulang, says his office and the UN partners are working on the National Action Plan for Return, Recovery and Reintegration to achieve a durable solution for the IDPs.
So we believe, based on the strategy that we already planned together with the UN partners, we both agree that we should help them, because now we understand, yes, they have health issues, they have sanitation issues, they have no clinic. So now, in the location that they have identified, the services will be added into those areas.
POC 3 is one of the largest camps in Juba, with over 60,000 people. 7,000 are South Sudanese returnees fleeing conflict in Sudan. For VOA News, I am Viola Elias in Juba.
From Juba, we move to Eastern Equatoria State, where communities in the state have imposed a ban on pastoralists from the Greater Pibor administrative area accessing Eastern Equatoria State. The community leaders accused the pastoralists of abduction, killing, and cattle raids. This comes after several children were abducted and an unknown number of cattle were stolen in some villages in eastern Equatoria, allegedly by pastoralists from the Greater Pibor administrative area. For VOA News, Kaltuma Vanessa reports from Torit.
Some community leaders from Tenant, Lopit, Lokoya, Peri and Toposa allege that criminal activities by pastoralists from Greater Pibor administrative area have affected communities across villages in Eastern Equatoria State. The leaders asked Louis Lobong, governor of Eastern Equatoria State, to impose a ban on across border movement between the two regions. Aziz Otulo is a community leader from Tenant.
Currently, we want to stop them not to enter to Eastern Equatoria again, because their motive at this time, as we are talking, is not good, according to us, because we have realized, like, the children in Loway have been taken, and also they are killing people in Loway and also in the site of Lavon County. So where the tenants are. We talk to these people from today onward, do not come here. When you come here, meaning you are our criminals already. You are not our brothers again.
Emmanuel Justin, a member of State Legislative Assembly in Eastern Equatoria State, says the move to ban pastoralists from Greater Pibor administrative area from crossing into Eastern Equatoria State will restore peace.
Murle, who are criminals, came here with purpose of stealing children from Eastern Equatoria State. Like I said, the people who are mostly affected by child abduction are our people from my area of Lokoya. Even when I recall in 2013, we make a peaceful demonstration. We don't want these people to enter Eastern Equatoria again. That time in 2013, when we counted, we found that 71 children were abducted from Lokoya area and 12 people were killed in the process. And what make us to be annoyed, we made a peaceful demonstration. We copy all the authorities in South Sudan, even the governor of Jonglei, because Pibor is under Jonglei state. We copy Central Equatoria, then we copy UNIMIS because of that bad activity.
Elia John Ahaj, Eastern Equatoria State Minister of Information, says the communities have the right to ban pastoralists from Greater Pibor administrative area from entering villages in the state.
Of course, when an abductor come or raider come, that is an enemy. They have to confront that person. And it will not cause any conflict between a community or a state and a state, because the community have not approved the coming of that criminal into that locality. So a criminal will remain a criminal. And once they are found, they will have to be treated as such. It is the Murle, actually, who are banning themselves from coming through their bad activities. You host them today, and tomorrow you hear they have done something.
The community leaders say they will instruct local youth group and community chief to prevent pastoralists from the Greater Pibor administrative area from entering into the villages in Eastern Equatoria State. South Sudan interim constitution guarantees from freedom of movement and choice of habituation across South Sudan. For VOA News, I am Kaltuma Vanessa in Torit, Eastern Equatoria State.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. The United Nations Human Rights Council says South Sudan's National Security Act is a threat. That story is coming up next.
Hello, listener of South Sudan in Focus. We have an exciting new segment dubbed Words of Wisdom. We want to hear your thoughtful proverbs that echo through your community. This is another chance for you to share wisdom from your roots. All you need to do is record a proverb in a language of your choice, tell us its English translation and what it means. Keep it brief, authentic, and represent your community. Your recorded proverb shall be sampled on South Sudan in Focus every Wednesday. Send your recording via our WhatsApp number, +1 202 630 8011. That is +1 202 630 8011.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. The United Nations Human Rights Council says South Sudan's National Security Service Act, passed by legislators last week, will entrench arbitrary detention and further repression by South Sudan's National Security Service. The head of the council, Yasmin Soka, urged President Salva Kiir to return the bill to legislators in order to align it with South Sudan's human rights obligations.
You know, last year, the commission actually conducted an investigation about the role that is being played by the National Security Service and the way in which that has led to real censorship, not just of the civilian population, but also censorship of the media and really harassment of civil society and political opponents. And I think what we singled out in our report is also the practice of arbitrary detentions and enforced disappearances, and also renditions of activists who have been in other parts of the region like Kenya and Uganda. And of course, once that's happened, they've been in detention indefinitely, and some of them have also been killed.
I would like us to go back to the sections that you mentioned, Section 54 and Section 55. What are the implications of these sections on the South Sudanese people? Because you say that the national security has records of arbitrary arrest, detention, and, you know, forceful disappearances.
Well, firstly, they don't align with any human rights regime, and certainly not with South Sudan's, in fact, the signatories to the International Convention on Civil and Political Rights. And so what Section 54 allows, that the SS can actually arrest any person without having an official warrant. And what that will mean is that people will get picked up and nobody will even know that, in fact, they've been arrested and detained. And then in addition to that, you have Section 55, which allows them to do that with a warrant. But at the same time, of course, the clandestine way in which the NSS has operated will mean that, in fact, people will get picked up in the country and nobody will actually know about what has happened to them. One of the issues that was raised last year in our report was, in fact, I think, a relic of how the NSS has modeled itself on, you know, the intelligence service of Sudan. And in fact, they set up what we would call ghost houses, which date right to the period before independence and which continue until now. And in fact, what we would say is, and I'm not sure, I'm sure you know very well, that nobody in South Sudan can actually hold any event at any venue if they do not have the permission of the NSS. And in fact,
what are some of the best practices, examples that the government of South Sudan should look into to avoid a copycat of the Sudan security system?
I think the first is obviously what had been intended to be, which was really a reform of the National Security Services. The second, of course, is to make sure that it's not used at the behest of the presidency and people who are close to him, and that, in fact, there should be civilian oversight, like there is in most countries, of the National Security Services. I think the third is making sure that, in fact, what we would call illegal operations, which are, you know, blocking off social media sites, phone hacking and intimidation and harassment should, in fact, stop. And of course, most of all, they should not have the power to arrest people, whether it's with a warrant or without a warrant, because that is actually a police service and not something that the NSS should be operating or implementing. The other is, of course, the closure of all of these unlawful detention sites and really publishing that where they do have these sites, that we actually know where they are, so that, in fact, there can be regular check of that. There's no judicial oversight like there is in many countries where you're expected to bring somebody before a judge or a magistrate within a particular amount of time. And so what that creates is also a lack of accountability in terms of question of governance.
That's Yasmin Suka, Commissioner at the United Nations Human Rights Council. She spoke to me from South Africa earlier today. Doctors Without Borders, also known as MSF, have evacuated its team from the Turkish hospital in Khartoum. The MSF team had been providing life-saving treatment in the hospital for nearly 14 months during the ongoing conflict between the Sudan Armed Forces and the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces. Claire Nicolet, head of MSF's emergency response in Sudan, spoke to VOA's Carol Van Damme about the decision.
Unfortunately, the past months, June, the months of June, it was very hard for the team with many intrusion inside the hospital and some violence with some armed men coming and shooting around for treating their patient quicker and so on. And really, the situation was so hard for the team that they requested to go out of the Turkish hospital for a little while at least. So the situation was really, really tense and very difficult to continue activities in Khartoum at the moment.
And I understand that even at one point recently at the Turkish hospital, the team was aggressively woken up and Kalashnikovs were fired in their bedrooms.
Yes, indeed. So the team has been living in the hospital for months now, most of the team at least. Unfortunately, yes, in June, there were some wounded because of the current fighting, obviously. And yes, armed men penetrated inside the house and the rooms of our staff and started shooting around. So fortunately, no one was wounded, but it was really, really very aggressive and complicated for the team.
Is surgery even still going on at this hospital?
So unfortunately, with the current situation, our team being outside of the hospital now, Ministry of Health is trying its best to continue activities, but surgery has to stop because of the lack of now and of MSF withdrawal for the moment.
Who controls this part of Khartoum? Why do you feel like, is there a blockade underway? And is that why you feel like you've had to pull out your team?
So unfortunately, we cannot rotate our team since October last year. So because of the blockade, indeed, both for personnel and also for supplies. So it means that Sudanese authorities have refused one after the other our request of travel permit to get to Khartoum, to this area under RSF control. Which means that indeed we cannot rotate our team. We didn't manage to send enough supply for almost 8 to 9 months. So the situation has been really, really difficult. And with the lack of staff and with the lack of protection as well of presence of our full team as much as we could.
Now that MSF has pulled out of Turkish hospital, at least for now, how many hospitals or health facilities are even operating still in the capital?
So there are very few hospitals working, functional at the moment. There are still a few of them, but for instance, for pediatrics, for maternity, it's really difficult now. And there are, for instance, neonatology, it's only in Turkish hospitals. So now I'm very unsure our Ministry of Health will manage to continue activity there and we will be able to treat this patient. So for surgery, there are 2 to 3 hospitals still operating, and obviously as well, because it's so difficult for the people to move around in the city, even to get there, it will not be easy to access the few operational hospitals.
So what is MSF asking for from both sides in this war?
Well, basically, we really call for warring parties to protect civilians, to protect health structures, to protect health staff. And unfortunately, that's not what we are witnessing for more than a year since the war started. And also to facilitate our activities by giving us travel permits, visas, which is also not granted for long times.
That's Claire Nicolet, head of MSF's emergency response in Sudan. She was speaking with my colleague Carol Van Damme from Paris. South Africa's newly appointed Minister of Sports, a self-described former gangster, wants to promote a sport that has associations with South African gang culture. The sports of spinning involves fast-moving cars and dangerous stunts. And as Kate Bartlett reports from Johannesburg, the way it's conducted is not always legal.
This is spinning, a turbocharged sport where drivers spin cars in quick, tight circles while passengers perform treacherous, sometimes death-defying stunts. The sport got its start in South Africa's poor townships during apartheid.
We have the best drivers in spinning. And you can see today, you can see there's no seat belts, there's no brakes, there's no windscreens, there's no helmets, but these people can control their cars. They are super, super, super drivers. I scream till my voice is gone, the way I'm excited about this sport.
Marvin Clark promoted this event, which drew several hundred paid spectators. Some spinning is at organized legal events like this one, but much of it takes place on the streets, where out-of-control cars have killed spectators in the past. Those events are illegal and associated with gangsters. One such former gangster is Gayton McKenzie, who was sentenced to 17 years for armed robbery in his youth.
I grew up where the area that you are born in decide which you don't have a choice in which gang you become. As a gangster, going to jail was a badge of honor. You've made your bones.
He came out of prison and went into politics, running on a populist anti-immigrant platform. Now he's South Africa's controversial new Minister of Sports, Arts and Culture.
And there's two reasons why I want to do this. Well, three reasons. Reason number one, there's a massive interest, was my first point I made to you. The second point you make is it's dangerous because they're doing it everywhere because the police are chasing them sometimes. Now, once you regulate it, once you make it safer, and once you put the rules there that you can't do this, you can't do that.
The longtime spinning aficionado says his first task in the job will be to promote the sport. Renowned car spinner Kyla Oliphant says she's hopeful about McKenzie's tenure as sports minister.
He'd like to make spinning big for us, legalize it. Obviously, we'd have the government behind us. I'm hoping that everything is going to go in the right direction, having funding for us, assisting us.
She explains how the sport originally started in the townships as a funeral rite to honor the deceased.
I think spinning is unique to South Africa, like each and every country has their own thing. Spinning back then started before my time. It started off as, people used to steal cars and spin around the coffin of the leaders.
For many who grew up in South Africa's impoverished urban areas, danger was always a reality, and spinning was, and still is, a way of life. Kate Bartlett, VOA News, Johannesburg.
That's all we prepared for you this Thursday, July 11, 2024. We now leave you with the song Siri Wangu by Lady J from Tanzania. I'm your host, John Tanza, on this live broadcast from Studio 14 here in Washington. On behalf of our producer, Kwame Ofori, and engineer, Bill Bass, we wish you a lovely evening. Remember to join us again tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
Mimi, Kajuta.